So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
From Variety, I'm Michael Schneider.
Wide awake, Glenn Miller.
Actor John C. McGinley grew up during the heyday of the classic 1970s sitcom when producers like Norman Lear and James L. Brooks ruled prime time. There were plenty of well-written comedies that acted almost like stage plays in those days, but for a young McGinley, there was something extra fascinating about Lear's Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton series, All in the Family.
I doubt I got all of it. It just... I was riveted by it. Can you be riveted by a sitcom?
I think so. I think.
I was riveted by All in the Family.
Yeah.
I had no idea where Norman was taking that thing. And I was a kid. So what year is All in the Family?
Started in 72. So lasted to 80.
Old.
Yeah.
12. And I'm sitting here talking to you about it in 2018.
Yeah. And the fact that you still get to talk to Norman Lear about that. And
oh,
he is...
I love you still. How about I just got to talk to
him? But Norman Lear, who I believe is 96 now, is when you talk to him, he is still on top of it. He is at the top of his game. He's producing. He is someone who is just still whip smart.
He's a political juggernaut.
Yeah. It's we all could only dream of being that active and that sharp when we get to that age.
Yeah, the other guy who does that, the guy who produces Stand Against Evil with me, Dana Gould, works for Mel Brooks.
Another one who...
And they work every day.
Yeah.
On, I don't know if I'm allowed to tell you what they're writing. But
yeah, I was about to say, what's Dana?
they're writing something, and they if Dana's not doing Stand... which he does tirelessly, he's with Mel Brooks over at MGM.
Wow.
That big white Tara-looking building.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right. There's that whole generation of...
Carl Reiner.
Yeah, I mean, Carl Reiner...
Carl Reiner.
Yeah, Carl Reiner. Not to be confused with Meathead. There's a bunch of them.
Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, who are...
We had Dick Van Dyke on Scrubs. He was miraculous.
Still, there was something in the comedy waters.
Because that whole group worked together.
Yeah.
On the show Mary Tyler Moore did, the one before it was Mary Tyler Moore, the Dick Van Dyke show. They all worked on that.
Yeah, well, they all, like, your show of shows.
They all worked with Sid Caesar.
Who was, really whip smart until the end of his life. So there was something about working in comedy at that time. I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the podcast, we talk to Stand Against Evil star John C. McGinley about his series, acting, Hollywood, and his wide-ranging career, which includes everything from Platoon and Office Space to Scrubs. And we talk about his favorite episode of TV of all time, All in the Family's Season 2 episode, The Elevator Story. It's my favorite episode.
My favorite episode's about to start.
Favorite episode.
Coming real, it's the next episode.
All in the Family was still a relatively new show just in its second season when the episode The Elevator Story aired on New Year's Day 1972. It was the first episode to take place entirely outside the bunker house, as Archie takes Edith, Gloria, and Mike out to dinner to celebrate Edith's birthday. But when he realizes that he forgot to mail an overdue bill, Archie races over to pay it, and gets stuck in an elevator with an African-American businessman, a Puerto Rican man with a wife about to go into labor, and a secretary. And Archie's in the middle of it all. For John C. McGinley, it was quite a memorable episode, and one that he even got to discuss with creator Norman Lear, a longtime idol of his. Currently, McGinley can be seen on IFC's Stand Against Evil, now in its third season, and McGinley said he was inspired by Archie Bunker in coming up with the motivation behind playing Stan. So when we asked the actor to select his favorite episode of TV of all time, it really was a no-brainer.
So I chose All in the Family, the scene, the episode from the second season where Archie is trapped in an elevator with a rainbow of minorities, a black couple, a Puerto Rican couple, and the Puerto Rican young woman is pregnant. And in fact, she will birth a child in the elevator in this episode.
Right.
And the only backstory on it that really salts the peanut in a more lovely way for me is that I got to meet one of the only people I hero worship, which is Norman Lear.
Yeah.
I got to meet him through my friend Paul Hipp. They have a podcast. And I met Norman, and I immediately started blurting out that we've crafted a TV series that we're in the third season of called Stand Against Evil. And the protagonist, we borrowed liberally from Carol O'Connor and Norman's rendition of this patriarch, this mm-hmm. kind of overbearing patriarch. And that lit his ears up. I meant it as a compliment. And that was to have terminated the conversation. Just I wanted to pay you, Norman, all respect and tell you that you are creatively and spiritually and emotionally helping me to really authentically create this guy from the archetype that you impacted in me so profoundly yeah. when I was growing up.
And now he's suing you for copyright infringement. But
no, what happened was that opened up the pathway to yeah. sharing stories. And so Norman, and I'd already read his book. This was when the book came out, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I'd already read the book, and he proceeded to tell me. In the book, he explores the elevator scene in pretty great detail, but in person, it's even better.
Yeah.
And so why did I spark to it? I sparked to it because... I guess knowing the backstory, Carol didn't want to do the episode. In fact, he didn't show up for work.
Yeah, yeah.
And lawyers got involved.
He was going to walk away because he didn't like the ending, right?
Correct. Or
what was the backstory there?
The backstory was he didn't want Archie in that circumstance.
How so? How come?
We'll never know.
Yeah.
But he either left the state or he left the stage and the where they shoot it? They shoot it over at Universal? Or they shoot it someplace else?
I think they shot at Metro Media, which is now
okay.
a high school. But
so they shot it all the way in town. We're here in Santa Monica or on the edge of Santa Monica, and so they were all the way in town. Carol leaves. The alarms start to go off. He's pulled back in, and begrudgingly he does the episode, and he's magnificent in it
yeah.
because he's largely a silent film star in the episode. He reacts more than Archie. Carol O'Connor made Archie, and Norman made him a classic initiator. He initiates everything. So yeah. in acting, you can do one of two things: you can initiate, and you can react. And if those are in balance, then you have a chance for something to percolate. If there's too many reactors, then it dies. If there's too many initiators, it's the stuff we hate to see when actors are like baby chicks in the nest, everyone's trying to get the worm. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
A perfect example of that is in Office Space. The two downsizers are me and this other actor from Chicago, and he was classic reactor. So I got to initiate all the interviews in Office Space, and then he was in a reactionary capacity.
Yeah.
And it gets to be music in improv.
Yeah.
It gets to be music. Anyway, I digress. So why it impacted me was a guy who functions so surgically in the format of All in the Family as an initiator, with Gene Stapleton always being a reactor and the Meathead always being a reactor and Gloria always being a reactor,
yeah,
all off of Archie just spitting out initiations. And in this, he can't. He's trapped.
Yeah.
And so he becomes this observer, and all of a sudden you see what a sublime, layered actor Carol O'Connor is. I didn't know Carol O'Connor, but he clearly impacted me pretty profoundly growing up.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, he's handed the baby, and he just starts to weep. I just got chilled. It caught me off guard. It catches me off guard right now thinking about it. And whatever, it's funny, taking some poetic license and speculating, maybe Carol didn't want to go there.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
maybe that's a really slippery place.
Yeah.
That quicksand of vulnerability where actors, when they go there, sometimes we go quick, and maybe that's not where Carol... I'm totally speculating.
Well, you know, it was only season two, so this was still pretty early in the process, so that may be part of it too, as he was still sort of exploring the lengths of who Archie Bunker is, maybe, and how far emotionally do you go with him. You know, the thing that I love, because I went back and rewatched it, is the sort of the sparring, speaking of the yin and yang, between him and Hector Elizondo, who plays the...
Not a bad guest star.
Right? And you know, so he plays the Puerto Rican, who's the janitor in the building, and that's why they're stuck in the elevator, because the janitor is the one who would generally help them out, but he's in the elevator with his pregnant wife. And there's that sparring, and then there's a African-American gentleman who's also in the elevator, but who actually harbors some racist thoughts towards Hector Elizondo's character. So sure. there's so much going on. And then who is it? Elaine, what's her name? Looking it up right now. Elaine Brennan plays the sort of ditzy secretary who's also in the elevator.
How about that for an ensemble?
It's a pretty great... I mean, that should have been a spinoff right there.
And that's your B team.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they should have just spun off the elevator group since Norman Lear was known to do that.
You could do worse.
Yeah. But I don't know if you had a chance to talk to Norman about this, but I've always been intrigued by his... He has a complicated feeling about ultimately how people took Archie Bunker. That, you know, obviously he was trying to make a statement about bigotry and put up Archie Bunker as a sign of this is ugly, this is what you should not be cheering, this is the old way. But people ended up loving Archie Bunker, and there were a lot of viewers who watched All in the Family and said, yeah, Archie Bunker's right. And that wasn't really Norman's intention. And I know he had sort of a complicated sort of relationship with that character as a result.
I have given no small amount of thought to that, selfishly, as it applies to the construct that we've... Dana Gould, who's the executive producer of Stand Against Evil, which is our show on IFC, which premieres third season on Halloween. and when we were constructing who and what Stan Miller is, you can stumble into the Archie Bunker archetype, but it gets slippery quick. And the reason it gets slippery is that they're equal opportunity offenders. And in 2018, we'll just change the channel. And so what floated Archie, what allowed us to, those of us who didn't love him politically, but loved him emotionally and satirically, it's Edith. And so... it's Gene Stapleton, who's so magnificent.
Yeah.
And so I asked Norman about this. I said, we borrowed from that for Stan. For Stan, it's his dead wife, and that redeems him. And I asked Norman about this at a dinner party we were at once, and he told me this really interesting story. He said one time, you might know the episode, one time they had a transgender storyline going. And the character gets killed. And Edith starts to circle the drain because her Christianity is a huge part of Edith's whole arc. Mm-hmm. And she starts to question her relationship with God. And so Norman wrote this, and then he couldn't figure out how to get her out of it, he told me. And so he went over to UCLA, and he talked to a psychiatrist over there. He went to Temple, and he talked to some rabbis. He talked to doctors. He told me he talked to everybody to figure out how he can get her out of this. And after all the dust had settled and he'd assimilated all the input, he realized it was because if she goes away emotionally and spiritually, Archie's dead.
Yeah.
She floats Archie. Archie can't take care of himself. And we saw it in Archie's Place. It's
it wasn't
largely
the same.
Less interesting.
Right, right.
There was some great stuff in Archie's Place, but those two together, Edith floating him, if she loves him, then there must be something there for us to love.
Yeah.
If Jean Stapleton, in her magnificence, can float that love and care for Archie, there's something there.
Yeah, yeah. And secondarily, Gloria and Meathead, there's... You know,
very secondarily.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the tipping point, we live and die with Edith.
Yeah.
And I can't believe we're talking about this 30 years later, but how... I don't know if you could pay an artist a bigger compliment.
Yeah. Well, when you mentioned that, you know, doing a transgender episode in the 70s... Yeah, that's still kind of revolutionary in 2018. We're just starting to see shows tackle that. So good. So
man, when we don't really have a writer's room on Stan, but we did when we were doing Scrubs over towards Valley Village, and we worked at a defunct hospital, and the different hospital could accommodate different groups. In other words, the actors were up on 3, and we shot on 4, 2, and 1. And over in the psychiatric unit was where the writers were housed, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
And they were in 2 separate rooms, and there would be 7 writers in each room, and they would leapfrog each episode, and Bill Lawrence, who was the executive producer, would ride shotgun over whatever was needed. But when you went into that writer's room, and I don't know what this is born out of. I remember there was a lawsuit on it from Friends, but you better have emotional Kevlar on. Because mm-hmm. they were savage.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no idea if it's still the same way, but Dana Gould ran the writer's room on The Simpsons
right.
for almost 10 years. I can't even imagine what that... Yes, I can. I can imagine what that writer's room is like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're right. There was that Friends lawsuit, and...
What was the Friends lawsuit? There was a young woman who... Yeah, that stuff wouldn't float in 2018, although I think it still does.
To some degree, yeah. I think it depends on the room, depends on the show as well. Well, let me ask you about something that's been interesting that sort of is, you know, what you did both on Scrubs and now with Stand Against Evil is you do play this kind of Archie Bunker-ish character who is surrounded by absurd situations. And obviously with Stan, it's you know, total sci-fi horror absurdity. Scrubs was much more just comedic absurdity. It was almost like you know, Simpsons. It had like the cutaways
and
things like that.
I disagree fundamentally in that both are grounded. Scrubs, the reason Scrubs worked is it's grounded in an emotional reality.
Yeah.
And so the people's favorite episodes of Scrubs are when the wheels are coming off for Cox.
Yeah.
When he loses the 3 patients to rabies, when Brendan Fraser comes on and dies. Those are across the board.
Yeah, yeah. Ones. And so that's what I was going to ask you about. Like, you know, these absurd situations, what was sort of the draw for you? And it sounds like it was sort of still the groundedness of it and the emotional groundedness of these stories. Even as there's cartoon elements happening, there's still these grounded stories also happening and the balancing all that.
Well, it's interesting. When Dana Gould, the creator of Stand Against Evil, came out to my house, and they brought all 8 episodes, and I had read them, and I thought they were great and really subversive and weird. But I told them, I said, this the catalyst for this idea that I'm about to share with you is born out of your scripts. So you're the one who did this. And he was scared. And I said, you're missing how damaged this guy is. This guy's wounded, and I can only play him. When men are wounded, they become more interesting.
Yeah.
And they're damaged. Like Billy Lawrence, Dr. Cox was the penultimate damaged alpha male.
Right.
That's why he was interesting.
Yeah.
Because he was... He, there were a lot of missing parts for that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And for Stan, we see in the... I told Dana, I said, you've written a guy who in the first 3 minutes that we meet him in the premiere episode, the pilot episode, he loses his wife of 27 years and his job of 26. He's been fired from his job, and he has nothing. He has a daughter who he loves, but she's, you know, the Jonathan Winters of her generation. And why are we just glossing over how wounded this guy is?
Yeah.
And I said, what's interesting and what writers can write are damaged characters. And I said, you got to promise me if I do this, we can excavate and dust off and make this guy responsible for what he's going to do about these wounds, mostly emotional and spiritual. Or is he not going to do anything? And that's interesting. Is he going to so overcompensate and not acknowledge what's missing? That's interesting. I said, but you, right now, we're just taking the express train past all these delicious stops we should be making on the local of and the train line would be the eccentricity train line would be damages you have to be you have to reconcile, and he did it. And so then I can turn a joke and Dana can write them. And I said, but what's going to be really interesting about this guy, and what was interesting about Cox was that they're hurt.
Yeah.
And when men are hurt, they're interesting.
And I think that's also why people still gravitated towards Cox on Scrubs. And, you know, when you go back to the Archie Bunker Edith comparison, obviously Zach Braff's character and his love for Dr. Cox and his need for Cox's love and approval and all that sort of gave us an in to also.
I buy that.
Really appreciate
that's
Cox.
Really interesting. I never thought about Archie Bunker specifically with Dr. Cox. He just never came on my radar.
Yeah.
It was immediately clear to me with Stan. Just because Cox is such a cog in the machine at that hospital, mm-hmm. and Stan's, you know, he's our guy. And I think, to me, I understand when you put it that way, there are some similarities. And what I always tell young actors when I'm working with them is that you're not any of these people. You're Bob. And if you can, I always ask them, how are we going to reduce the profundity of the lie that you're going to exercise in front of the lens? How can we do that? Oliver Stone helped us by putting us through this 3-week boot camp in platoon. Now, we didn't become soldiers, but it allowed people's, hopefully actors are gifted and cursed with these imaginations that help them take a leap. If you get them a little closer to whatever the truth is, they can take a leap. And we were able to in platoon. And with Dr. Cox, you got to move them a little closer, because actors, what we're doing in front of the lens, I heard Malkovich say this once, it's just the whole thing's a big fat lie. And when it gets good is when the lie, like Bob De Niro became a boxer for all of us in Raging Bull. He's not a boxer, but we bought it.
Yeah.
He reduced the width of the lie. And that's all you're trying to do.
Yeah.
And whether it's grounding it in something, you know, Robin Williams and Jim Carrey, those guys can do it with sheer will and agility. We're not them. Nobody else. You know who's Robin Williams? Robin. You know who's Jim? Jim. They're the only ones who can do it. Jonathan Winters could do it. The rest of us have to find something, because that lens is like an X-ray machine. And if you try to BS that lens, it'll just, the X-ray will come out negative, and you'll be exposed for being not good at storytelling, because we're not buying it. For some reason, we don't even know why. It's just the lens doesn't suffer your lie unless you reduce the profundity of it. If you can just reduce it. I don't even know what percentage or what the quantum math of it is all. It is for everybody, but there's just ways. So when actors play doctors, they're not doctors, but if you hang out with a doctor, and like I did for, you know, my son was born in down in Santa Monica, and I was in the hospital for a long time because of our challenges, and you start to get some of that on you, and hopefully actors can access those memories and experiences and wear them, and then the lens can be tricked just a little bit. And then I'm pretty sure that's what good acting is.
Well, it sounds like Dana took your suggestion to heart.
He sure did.
That it really became sort of a driving force for the series going forward, and Stan's sort of, you know, wish of somehow being reunited with his wife, finding a way to, but the challenges that came with that, and now he's dealing with the aftermath.
It's great that he's not good at it.
Yeah, yeah. So talk.
But he's willing to reconcile this loss. He's willing to if you're he's willing to roll it. But he's not good. He's not equipped for any of this. He probably never pulled his gun in the 27 years of working in this town, this mythical town of Willard's Mill. He never pulled his weapon, ever. And now there's 172 witches trying to kill him, and all he wants to do is get on his recliner and watch the History Channel. It's great.
Yeah.
It's great when people are under-equipped to do something that they have to do. They're not choosing to do it. They just have to do it. And what makes Stan a really delicious anti-hero is that he will fight these witches and he will do the right thing, but only in the bottom of the ninth with the bases jacked. And the motivating factor is he doesn't want to hear about it if he doesn't.
Right.
That's just great. And that's our hero. That's who we're pinning our hopes on. Call action and get out of my eyeline. That's delicious.
Yeah, and things that as we head into,
I mean, he doesn't want the championship belt. He doesn't want to put the world on his shoulder. He just doesn't want to hear about it.
Yeah, yeah. That's why he keeps slamming the door on whoever shows up at his
absolutely.
House.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's not an act.
Yeah,
that's his truth.
Yeah,
it's great.
I enjoyed, by the way, the episode 2 of season 3, the X-Files parody. Having some fun with while the world is crumbling, and as Stan is trying to, figure out, how to save the world, and it's an interesting dichotomy in that Stan doesn't want to face it, he doesn't want to deal with all this stuff, but yet he's sitting down, he's reading these texts, these ancient texts, and he's trying to figure things out on his own terms.
Well, I think the way Dana has it structured now is the new normal is 8 episodes, and so. Of the 8 episodes in each season, 4 are witch or bad guy of the week, and 4 are mythology that move the mythology of the show forward. And so Dana this year decided to have a heavy, heavy dose of horror Hall of Famers and scary Hall of Famers, of which he knows backwards. And so, yeah, Kolchak shows up in there.
Yes, love the...
For people who know who Darren McGavin was.
Love the Kolchak reference,
There's a Mothra episode where David turns into a Godzilla. For people who know Godzilla, at one point he fights him off. I didn't. And there's a couple of these throughout the season. Oh, we have puppets. That are bad guys in one. They're possessed by witches. That's like a fever dream. It's insane. And, we show this stuff down at these comic cons and people go nuts.
Yeah.
Because there's a certain bandwidth. It's not for everybody. And if you don't know what this stuff is, it doesn't matter. It's wildly entertaining. But there's people who know all this stuff. We just got back from New York Comic Con, and we showed the Godzilla Mothra one. People were going bananas.
Yeah,
yeah, it's great. Yep. And that's all Dana. He knows all this stuff.
How do you shoot it? Is it?
We do something which is again the new normal, called cross blocking.
Yeah, that's so hearing a lot about that now.
So in other words, when you and I are in this podcast room for episodes 1, 5, and 8. We're shooting out this interior all this morning. We're going to shoot we're going to shoot the master of you and I sitting here talking in 1, 5, and 8. Then we're going to change your wardrobe for 5 and 8, mine. And then we're going to shoot your coverage, your singles. We're never coming back to this location, this podcast location. We're going to shoot, the whole crew is downstairs, 150 people, light and cable into this room, but we're never coming back here. And so it's called cross-blocking. And I love it because I love putting blinders on like a Kentucky Derby thoroughbred and just, this is what we're doing for these 5 weeks. It's 5 weeks to shoot 8 episodes, which is preposterous.
Right, right.
So each episode's about 3.25 days, which is absurd.
Which is absurd. That's because how many days did you shoot a Scrubs episode? It was like...
5.5, 6. Yeah. And those are 16-hour days.
Yeah.
Over towards Valley Village. When we're in Atlanta, those are 12-hour days. We don't have the money to pay the grips and electric and everybody OT and the actors. It's 12 hours. There's no overtime. So the only trade-off here, so it doesn't turn into a gripe fest. First of all, it's not a gripe fest because I love shooting this way.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm going to do on a film set now, where it's hurry up and wait for 6 hours while, you know, the Hungarian DP changes the lighting. And that's an homage to Vilmos Zsigmond, who was with us on Fat Man and Little Boy. But he was slow.
Yeah. And you only get like one scene in a day.
I forgot what I was saying.
You were just saying it's going to be hard to go back to a movie set now that you're like in this like fast paced. Yeah.
We go.
I mean, is it like one take or?
No, the takes are never. That's the big misnomer.
Yeah.
The takes aren't what take time. What take time is lighting you and then coming around and lighting me and then moving back and getting the master and lights and cables. And now your key light went out. And so now it's a half hour to fix that
right.
key light. And are we going to now just move you over here and make it a two shot? So that we're both sitting next to each other and not look. We have to do something. But it's thrilling. And the trade-off, I know what I was moving towards. The trade-off for this cross-blocking is Dana and I are afforded an enormous amount of creative autonomy. And the reason that's important is that both of us are obsessed with shepherding the tone of the piece. And what I mean is, with it as horror comedy, that spectrum that where it lives in is the two extremes would be The Exorcist, which is scary as hell, but you can't, you're not really going to break a joke. You might, but not really. And the other is Scooby-Doo, where it's funny, but the monsters are largely not a threat.
Right.
And so the all-timers that live in the middle there are Bruce Campbell's show, and An American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
What Landis did with
right.
that is that's kind of the high point. How he mixed, you know, when Griffin and those guys and Naughton are looking at that wolf, and you remember what Stan Winston won an Academy Award when his thing is growing. That's not green screen. They invented that. It's scary as all get out. That wolf is scary.
Yeah.
But then you get Griffin, who's a ghost, dropping jokes everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, with that face. And the whole time, Griffin Dunn. And he's just, it's hilarious. That's what
yeah.
Stan aspires to mirror.
Yeah, yeah. And I would
say. And it's hard, because if the jokes cannibalize, or the jokes can't cannibalize, if the monster cannibalizes the jokes, you're dead. And if the jokes are at the, you know, if you just keep throwing body shots at the monster and you declaw the monster, you blew it.
Yeah, because you got some gross and scary monsters on this show.
This year, one of the takeaways from last year was the monsters got to be scarier.
Yeah, yeah.
And
was that a network note, or was
no,
that just
no,
a...
No, they largely leave us alone.
Yeah.
Because Dana is so locked in that they don't want him... It's just like Billy Lawrence on... they're both great at their jobs. They've done this before. And they just make the network's job easier.
Yeah.
And so, no, we are not micromanaged. And Billy wasn't micromanaged. And that's why the thing comes out so well.
Yeah, yeah. But this was sort of just a feeling that you had in talking to fans or watching
no,
yourself.
No, from Go, Dana yeah. and I were like, this is where this thing lives.
Yeah.
And it's easy to forget you live in the middle of those two.
Yeah.
Because either one can subvert the other quick, and then you blew it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting tightrope because you have there are scenes where it gets to be really gruesome and you forget for a second that I was just laughing a second ago, and then vice versa, the laughs come in and you're like, oh, this is coming down easy, I'm not too scared. And
then Dana did this. I don't know how much of season three you've seen, but Dana did this unbelievably risky thing with the last two episodes, which work as a paired set, 307 and 308. That is going to leave everybody who watches Stan scratching their head.
Yeah. Does that lead into season four or?
Yeah, but he always, like at the end of season two, when I asked him, you know, he's just ended the world and now hell has descended on earth. I said, where are you going? He goes, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, he picked up right from the final scene in season two.
I thought the way he did the first season of season three was so much grace and spine. And what I mean is, season two, as it wraps up, it's the end of the world, he could have just done a J.R. Ewing, I know I'm dating myself, with Bobby. Somebody's head could have bumped against the shower. Somebody could have had a bad dream, and none of that could have happened. But instead, he owned it, and he made it so that the two protagonists, Janet Varney's character, Evie, and mine, the direction of the first episode of season three is if they can chart a course through their own personal hell, they get to come back to here.
Yeah.
In a 21-minute and 35-second horror comedy, that's pretty esoteric, and he nailed it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's one of the best episodes we did. Because, first of all, descending out of the ashes of where the last episode of season two is, and then arriving at a springboard into season three, I thought the writing was sublime.
Yeah, because you're right. Weren't quite sure where he would go from there. And
no, it could have been the old lazy writers convention of somebody bumped their head. Somebody had a bad dream. But he didn't go there.
Now, you mentioned that Dana, obviously, is a horror fan through the years. What about
He's a horror fanatic.
Yeah. Where did you stand on horror?
I like more scary than I do the guy behind the door. Mm-hmm. Like, the scariest thing for me, and I saw it too young, was Wait Until Dark, when Richard Crenna and Alan Arkin are playing good cop, bad cop with a hearing-impaired Audrey Hepburn in the basement of a Greenwich Village flat. And I never saw the play. I just saw the film. And it was too scary. Alan Arkin was just, I guess he was having the best time ever. He just was terrifying to me.
So you're more into the psychological thrillers,
yes,
than necessarily the...
Yes.
The gruesome stuff.
I get too scared.
Yeah.
I get way too... Nicole, my wife, I get way too scared. Like, when I saw Halloween, I was the first year of school I went was Ohio Wesleyan. I was in Delaware, Ohio. And that first Halloween came out, I guess that was the scariest thing I ever saw.
Yeah, I find that I like my horror with a nice dose of comedy.
Same here.
And so...
Because
so,
I want to surrender to you telling your story, if you let me. If you take me out of it because you suck, then I can't. But if you're going to execute your story and I'm going to watch this, I really want to surrender to the storyteller, and I want to see everything you're doing, and then you're going to scare the living shit out of me, and it's going to get on me for a while.
Yeah.
I'm going to look around the door a little bit, and I don't want to.
Yeah, yeah.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, for me, because I was a kid in 1984 when Ghostbusters came out, that was the pinnacle. Because I was the right age to be perfectly spooked by some of the ghosts on there, but it was hysterical at the same time.
Yeah, I guess I should put Ghostbusters up there with... I never thought of that. Yeah. But is Ghost...
It's
is
not
enough scary stuff.
It's not
in there?
As scary, and especially now as adults, it's not as scary as say even like American Werewolf in London. But there's elements of some...
Yeah, maybe I'll sprinkle that in there.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, because that kind of lives in the wavelength I'm talking about. I think they wanted to put some scary stuff in there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was the right amount. So you're liking the series world in addition to the film world. Is this you still like to go back and forth, or
yeah,
do you find that the line has blurred at this point that you,
I've always
doesn't
thought
really
it
matter? Yeah,
whether you're doing, I was lucky enough to do a revival of Glengarry on Broadway with Al Pacino and Bobby Cannavale a couple of years ago, and to me, and I work with young actors, and they all want to know. But to me, there's no difference. Either the curtain's coming up or someone's calling action, and you have to do something. You have to move some aggressive verb that serves the text forward. You have to do something, and the rest of it is all noise. It doesn't matter if you're at the Schoenfeld 8 nights a week doing Glengarry or in Atlanta doing Stan. When somebody calls action or the curtain goes up, we have to do something. We have to share stories. We have to engage each other. Whatever the verb is. It's distilled that clarity. I've arrived at that clarity.
What do you get asked the most when people see you, say, at the airport or in the street?
It's demographically specific.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how politically correct... I don't know how to do it with political correctness. But different people ask me about different stuff.
Yeah.
Whether it's Scrubs or Office Space or now Stan or Platoon or Wall Street or The Rock... That sounds arrogant as I'm saying it. I don't mean it to, but that's what the stuff gets fired at me.
Well, that's kind of cool that it's not
it
one thing
cool.
that it's you're
lost
not
on me.
Yeah, you're not being repeated to ask about a certain thing or talk about a certain thing.
No.
You know, it's so funny. Speaking of Office Space, Ron Livingston was here yesterday.
He's the best.
And we were talking about, you know, he's got so many things going on right now at the same time, too, including Louder Milk, which is a cable show that he shoots just like Stan. You know,
oh, does he?
Yeah, sort of the cross-boarding. So we talked a lot about that. And he had sort of the same thing. A lot of people ask him still about Office Space. You know, some people
he's great in it.
Yeah. He kind of feels the same way, very lucky to have done multiple things, not being pigeonholed by comedy or drama or horror or what have you. That's sort of the actor's dream, right?
I think if you want to do this for a living, then if you're lucky enough to get paid enough to do it for a living, then yeah, there's a premium on being nimble, on being agile, within a certain spectrum. You know, I'm reminded of when we used to go in an audition at Donna DeSetta, right behind the post office on like 34th and 9th. That was the commercial place where you'd go and audition in Manhattan. And there was always, you know, every commercial wants a Ken and Barbie type. And they'd have an African-American Ken and Barbie, they'd have a white Ken and Barbie, and then they'd have the altered Ken and Barbie. And about a half a dozen times, it was me and Frenny McDormand. Mm. And so I never got the Ken and Barbie. But I got their dirty uncle. And that's a better role.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a better role. But for a little while there, you really want to get the Ken and Barbie guy. And that ship sailed. And it's liberating.
Yeah. And there's possibly more longevity to be the creepy uncle.
Fact. Although I haven't gotten to be the creepy uncle. I got to play him.
So what are you excited about? What's next on your docket that you can talk about?
We have this weekend, we have our gala in Denver at the Global Down Syndrome Foundation, where we have this fabulous night. It's called Be Beautiful, Be Yourself fashion show. And we bring in young people up and down the age spectrum who were all born with Down syndrome. And then we couple them with different celebrities. Jamie Foxx is on the board with me. And we bring in a bunch of celebrities this year, including Colin Farrell and Jeremy Renner. And the models walk the runway with different celebrities. And it's pretty much the highlight of our year. And we bring the whole family goes. And it's great. It's a fundraiser. And then on November 30th, I was invited to give the keynote address at the Special Olympics 50th anniversary dinner in Washington, D.C. And I get nervous. Yeah. I haven't written it yet.
Yeah.
But that'll be one for the books.
Ask Dana to punch it up a little bit for you.
I will send Dana a draft. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll send Billy a draft, too.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
You have some great comedic minds at your fingertips.
They will. Yes.
Yeah,
that'll ride out the year. And getting Stan, you know, in TV, the mandate is always get next year. Unless you're at one point, NBC bought Scrubs for 3 years. That doesn't happen anymore. People's exposure, networks' exposure, they trim their sails now. It's a tighter business construct, and so the mandate is promote Stan and get year four and do year four, and that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to ride Stan for a while.
So we are contractually obligated these days to ask every person the same question, which is reboots. If someone came to you and said, we want to do another season of Scrubs, or we want to do a couple episodes of Scrubs, we want to bring back the band, and
I don't think it would look like a season. I think it would be something different, primarily because that ensemble has all Billy populated that ensemble with working actors.
Yeah,
Neil has been on The Middle for 10 years now, and now he has a new show. Zach is a very successful director now. Donald has a new Star Wars thing. Sarah's on Roseanne. Kenny, I don't know what Kenny's doing, but that would be, I think everybody would do it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it looks like 20. It looks like 22 episodes.
Yeah, maybe it's like 5 or something. These days, it seems like everyone has an opportunity to do so many different things at the same time. Now that
I know, but
these...
I saw a piece in one of the trades this morning where audiences' appetites for reboots is going south.
I saw that too, and I think there is that element as well. So
because it would also be, you know, we did almost 200 episodes of Scrubs, and so. If you didn't wring that towel dry of everything you wanted to get out of those characters, it begs the question: what were you waiting for?
Right. You even had that final Franken-Scrub season.
It was a great season. It was in the middle of the recession.
Yeah.
And Billy called the show. We'd already shot the series
finale. Yeah.
Series, not the season. Series, and everyone was going off to do their things, and Billy called, and another network picked it up, ABC picked it up, and Billy called, and this is the middle of the recession, and he said, ABC wants to do 17 or 18 of them, and you'll get the money you got for season 8. If you get a film, I'll write you light, and you can go, we can be really flexible here. Recession, there were no jobs. It was the easiest decision in the history of the world.
Yeah.
It wasn't even... I mean, you'll get paid season 8 money, which was an enormous amount of money, not in compared to Friends and stuff like that. But for us, you were trading at your highs.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you can come back at season 3 dough. You got to bite the bullet creatively. It's like, no. So the only reason I say that is because were there some Scrubs thing, people are going to want to get they're going to want to get paid. And
yeah.
So, That'll be a variable. Since creatively, what are you looking to do?
Right.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if some variation of that doesn't realize fruition. And I don't know what it looks like.
Right.
A 2-hour movie for so-and-so? I don't know.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Or a special episode of another Bill Lawrence series?
No, you couldn't pay the people enough.
Yeah.
Well, I love Billy, so if Billy's doing it, then people come to Billy because he and Dana are the Norman Lears of their generations. They're great at this.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is this? Making really good television, which is impossible.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, both of them trained under, Bill Lawrence under Gary David Goldberg.
Oh, good memory, yes.
And of course, Dana just going through the Simpsons. How is that not like the perfect boot camp for writing comedy? So,
there are guys who did both of those things who didn't rise the way Billy and Dana did. And so what's great about Billy and Dana, one of the great things about them, is on any set, they're the hardest working people. That's contagious.
Yeah.
They're not looking to go do a 2-hour lunch with their lawyer over in Beverly Hills. They're on the floor of the hospital. They're at Stan's house when it's 115 degrees in Georgia and the humidity's 90 and there's a lightning strike two miles away and the grips are threatening to shut us down. They're there. Reminds me of my one of my heroes, Arnold Copelson, rest in peace, who just passed, who produced Platoon. Arnold was in the Philippines with us. He wasn't back here at whatever the fancy lunch place was, the lunch du jour. Arnold was in the Philippines with us.
Yeah, boots on the ground.
He was there.
Yeah.
And so was his wife, Anne, was there. Oh, I'll start crying. And that's different.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can tell with Dana, well, with the both of you, I mean, I can't imagine.
Have you spoken with Dana yet?
I've talked to Dana before.
He's the best.
He's a great guy.
He's really smart, and he's really funny. So is Billy.
Yeah. I love Billy. I've known him for years, too. But I get the sense, doing a show for IFC, you don't have the biggest budget in the world. So is that the understatement of the century? But you guys, so you got to be scrappy, right? You got to be a little smart and figure out a way to shoot this show. And
yes.
And so that's part of it.
If you get over your skis, you're dead. Because we're not going to clean this up on a green screen. We're not going to do reshoots. We're not going to do pickups. There's no such thing. The you know, doing the green screen and all the computer stuff, that's expensive.
Yeah.
We have you in a rubber suit, and you're the monster. And you've been in makeup for 13 hours, and we haven't gotten to you yet. And so, you gotta, yeah, scrappy is a good, you got to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like big boys and big girls. And you got to play together. And all the actors have to rehearse this like a play. Because as I was suggesting to you earlier, if we shoot 1, 5, and 8 this morning in this podcast room, and your aunt, in the context of the show, dies between 5 and 8, and she had a huge imprint on you, you're going to be different between 5 and 8. Well, we're shooting that all out here today. So you better have worked with your teacher and gotten all this, the whole arc of your season, hypothetically, has got to be squared away in your actor brain.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're dead.
Yeah.
We don't have time for you to go chant in the corner and light some incense and fashion a ceremony that's going to allow the spirits, the acting spirits, to come to you and you and for you to ride. There's no time.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you thrive on that. I know some people probably don't. It's probably quite a learning process for others who have to adjust to that.
Well, the core ensemble of Stan has gotten great at it.
Yeah.
Janet's unbelievable. I've called her the Jonathan Winters of her generation. That's not by mistake. Deborah is astonishing. And then Nate has had to do a lot of who, what, where, when, how for two seasons, which is pretty thankless. And Dana put all he could eat on his plate this year. And Nate just shines. And he just steals season 3. It's great.
Well, John, congrats on season 3.
Thank you.
And looking forward to seeing the rest of it into season 4.
I can't wait for you to see it.
So, yeah, no, it sounds like some surprises for those final two episodes. So be looking forward to that. But good luck with everything. Good luck with your event this weekend and also your speech. So, John, not to put the pressure on you there. But,
oh, it's on. So, 22 minutes.
So,
Phil, 22 minutes.
All right, well, hopefully someone will be recording it and we'll watch it on YouTube when all is said
it
and
done.
It
won't disappoint, I guarantee you.
Well, great. Well, thanks, man. Great talking to you.
Cheers.
And that's it for this edition of My Favorite Episode. Join us again next time as we once again explore another guest pick. And be sure to subscribe to My Favorite Episode on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com for your daily fix of TV news, analysis, and reviews. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you again next time.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.